This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to take a look at gun-toting women in American culture and history. Our guest is Laura Browder, the author of Her Best Shot, Women and Guns in America. Browder says the story of women and guns in America includes women who fought in the Revolutionary War, Wild West stars, gangsters, revolutionaries of the right and left, housewives, and today's female soldiers. Listeners, I look forward to your telephone calls. Your questions and comments are invited. The telephone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Laura Browder is an associate professor of English at Virginia Commonwealth University, where she teaches in the creative writing program. Her Best Shot, Women and Guns in America, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Browder, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Tell us the story of how your interest in guns and women and your interest in guns in general began.
Well, it really all started with a move to the South from New England, where I had grown up and lived all my life. And I had grown up in a very anti-gun culture where no one I knew owned a gun and where we all thought the people who did were just these crazy people, you know, on the fringe somewhere. And I moved to Richmond, Virginia, and suddenly started to realize that many, many people who I knew and liked and were my neighbors and friends were gun owners. And this got me thinking about guns. And I was also doing some research at the time on Women of the Wild West shows for another book I wrote. And one thing led to another, and I started thinking about the question of how women and guns were connected. Because, you know, in this country, we associate American identity and gun ownership so closely, and this is really what I saw all around me living here in the South, but we also associate gun ownership and masculinity. So I started wondering, where does this leave women in the equation? And that began a long, long path of doing research into all kinds of things that you've already mentioned, and got me into some kind of surprising areas. There were gun-toting women in places and times that I had never imagined or known about.
Yeah. In general, would it be fair to say that we feel conflicted about women and guns?
Absolutely, and that was another thing that really fascinated me, because on the left, we're conflicted about women and guns because we think that no one should have guns, right? That gun ownership is not a good thing. And on the right, I think we're conflicted because a woman with a gun can be a very threatening thing. It's a very threatening image. And it's difficult for many people to think of mothers with guns, for instance. So there are all kinds of reasons why the armed woman makes us uncomfortable, no matter where we're coming from along the political spectrum.
Oh. You begin the book with an overview of some recent developments regarding women and guns. These include the NRA reaching out to women and a line of guns for women from Smith & Wesson.
Absolutely, the Lady Smith.
Yeah. So what else have you seen of interest and in terms of recent developments? And talk about how you put this all together. What do you see in these developments, if anything?
Well, one of the main things that I see is the gun industry looking for cover in a certain way, looking to soften its image by associating women with guns. So in the 90s, a lot of people were really turned off to guns and our gun laws, which are, as you know, very lax in many parts of the country. You know, the school shootings in Columbine and elsewhere made people very nervous about guns and about the NRA. You know, when Timothy McVeigh was arrested, it turned out that he had sent sent letters with stamps on the back of them that said, you know, I'm the NRA and I vote. He was an NRA member, and the NRA leaders made some intemperate statements at that time, and people, by and large, were very offended and started to think that gun ownership was all about these crazy macho guys out there doing crazy things. So at that point, the NRA and the gun industry decided that it made sense to market to women, to launch a series of ad campaigns, such as the Refuse to Be a Victim campaign that the NRA had, which showed gun ownership as something that women could be involved in, and now that the NRA has a magazine called Woman's Outlook, gun ownership as a family activity and as part of American heritage and as a way to keep the family together. You know, in other words, to disassociate guns from crazy violence.
Mm.
So that's a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, it is a piece of American heritage.
Absolutely. And that's something that, again, I grew to appreciate very much living here in the South and realizing that people had guns that were handed down for generations, which were very important to them as part of their family identities. But, you know, moreover, one of the things that I discovered when I started researching these gun ads aimed at women, I thought, well, this is something brand new. But I came to find out quickly that, in fact, 100 years ago and more, gun ownership among women was something that was very much promoted by the industry. You know, there are these incredible ads from the 1880s and 1890s showing women in Victorian dresses surrounded by their children in their parlors shooting. Or women, you know, sturdy, middle-aged women out alone in the woods with their canoes and their packs and their rifles hunting. So there's this whole lost legacy that we have of armed women in our culture.
There's also an ad that you include in the book. I don't know how far back it goes, but it was pretty shocking to me. It features a little girl, a tot. And she's part of an advertisement for a safety hammer automatic revolver.
Oh, yes. It's a wonderful ad. I mean, it's a horrifying ad, but such a dramatic illustration. She's pointing the gun at her face, and the handwritten caption says, "Papa, you know, don't worry about leaving your gun around the house now that Smith & Wesson has this new safety feature."
Yeah.
And there are other ads that I didn't include in the book, of little girls curled up with their dogs and their hunting rifles, which are bigger than they are, you know, out in meadows someplace.
Yeah, very interesting. How many women today own a gun or guns, or is it possible to know that?
It's not really possible to know, and even the editor of Women and Guns magazine says that the number could be anywhere between 11 million and 17 million women. The NRA doesn't keep statistics on how many of its members are women, and the firearms industry doesn't really keep statistics. When I talk to the owners of gun stores and when I talk to vendors at gun shows, they all do say that many more women come in than used to. But how this translates into actual numbers, I don't think anyone really knows.
Yeah. Do we have any kind of an inkling how what's going on today compares with gun ownership in the past, say, 100 years ago?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to it. But I do know that I'd say 100 years ago, probably gun ownership was more common among women. Annie Oakley, the Wild West shooting star, had a huge influence on women as gun owners and shooters. She personally taught 15,000 women to shoot. And during her time, she popularized the sport by disassociating guns with violence and instead showing them to be a sort of fun sporting tool. You know, women's trap shooting clubs were very popular at the turn of the century. And women were encouraged to hunt. It was all part of Theodore Roosevelt's injunction to strenuous living. You know, they thought that they could build up the white race by going out into the woods and breathing fresh air and hunting.
Now, there's a number of things that you said in the last minute or two here that we'll try and tease apart, build up the white race, which is very provocative. But let's talk a little bit about Annie Oakley, because I think she's an interesting figure. She thought every woman should know how to operate a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Why did she feel that way?
She felt that women needed to be able to protect themselves against rapists and against violence in general. She's a very interesting figure, because although she was a very strong woman and a very famous woman, an accomplished woman, she was also very much an anti-feminist. She didn't believe that women should have the vote. She believed that women should only ride side saddle, which is what she did. She made a big point of sewing all of her own costumes. She cultivated a sort of girlish image. She had a trademark little skip and pout when she went into the ring. And in a lot of ways, she fashioned herself, I think, into the kind of woman who would be acceptable to the public as an armed woman. In other words, she was as non-threatening as she could be. And she really looked to distance herself from the kind of bad Western women that were famous at that time, like Calamity Jane, who were hard-drinking, hard-living, tough-looking, and sometimes criminal, and who were often photographed with their guns.
Mm. How did the public respond to a figure like Calamity Jane?
Well, they were fascinated by her. You know, she also toured with Wild West shows. You know, everyone was out there promoting themselves, it seems, during the 1880s and 90s. She was right in there. You know, she wrote an autobiography, a very short one, and peddled it on the road. I think people were fascinated by her. But she couldn't really work herself into a kind of money-making system the way Annie Oakley could. Mm-hmm. Annie Oakley was very, very good at managing her own image. It's interesting, there was another shooting star who was also in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at the same time as Annie Oakley. Her name was Lillian Smith. And many commentators at the time thought that she was a better markswoman than Annie Oakley was. But Lillian Smith was darker-skinned. She was plump. She had an outrageous fashion sense. She slept around. She drank too much. And she ended up having to leave the show and reinventing herself as an Indian princess and had a second career as Winona, the monolingual Sioux princess.
Hmm.
So she couldn't quite make herself fit into the paradigm of the girlish, demure markswoman that Annie Oakley could.
Good girls and bad girls.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. I mean, you see that all throughout the story of women and guns in the United States.
Yeah. Now let's talk about something that is very interesting as well that you write about in Her Best Shot, and that is the first gun control laws in this country were Jim Crow laws.
That's right. In fact, no, and this is something that I very much agree with the NRA about. Civil rights and gun ownership have always been tied up together. Going back to some of the earliest laws in the Virginia colonies, which specifically forbade gun ownership to blacks. And those kinds of laws have gone on, you know, well into the 19th century and even beyond. And the beliefs that gun ownership is racially determined could even be seen in the 1960s, where many blacks in the South believed mistakenly that it was illegal for them to own guns because of this kind of racialized history of gun ownership.
Hmm. A couple of things that you write about that are very interesting, and I think that could give us here some more material to talk about and to think about our history and guns. You write that the combat-ready woman soldier has been a figure of controversy since the founding of the United States. And I mentioned in my introduction, there were women who fought in the Revolutionary War. You also say that the gun suggests a close connection between violence and citizenship. So, So what does this say about our ideas about citizenship, who is and who isn't, and what it means to be a citizen?
Well, I think that suggests that we do have an idea of citizenship, which for the past 200-plus years has been tied up with the ability to fight in war, and that women have struggled with this definition, you know, really since Revolutionary War times. What does it mean if the only way you can be a full citizen is to engage in combat? I mean, this was something that feminists in the mid-19th century delivered lots of speeches about and wrote papers about and challenged and said, well, there are plenty of men who don't fight in battle. Does that mean that they're not real citizens? But they could never quite get beyond this. And even today, you know, the proponents of what they call armed feminism argue that the only real way for women to have full rights, full citizenship, is to be gun owners. And I think it's a very limiting idea of citizenship because, I mean, does this mean that if you're going to be an armed feminist, you're going to get a raise by shooting your boss? You know? I mean, it's impractical. It's limiting. And yet, I think we're still struggling with it as a culture.
Well, it is a tool of power, no doubt about that.
It's a tool of power, but it's a very specific kind of power.
Right.
And I think we need to get beyond that.
Yeah. Another interesting figure, speaking of feminists, Lucretia Mott. Talk about her view of suffrage and how she predicted it would transform the model of the citizen soldier.
She predicted that, and in some ways she was right, but in some ways that model has hung on, and, you know, you still hear that in the current debates about women in the military, which is very interesting. I mean, I don't know if you've heard any of the debates with the people from the Center for Military Preparedness, which is a think tank that's opposed to women in combat, but you hear echoes of the same arguments that have been going on for 200 years about why women really should be at home being mothers and shouldn't be soldiers. And they really boil down to a lot of the same issues. So in some ways, we've come very far, and in other ways, not so much.
Yeah. Well, also complicating this idea of citizen-soldier is it's a little bit of a muddle, I think, because we no longer have the draft. We have a volunteer military. But once upon a time, when you had the duty, if you were a man, you had the duty to serve, you could pay someone to take your place.
That's a good point.
So it's almost like, you know, the citizen soldier thing is kind of a funny thing.
It's a very funny thing. And in fact, the point that you just made about being able to pay a substitute is something that came up in one of the great kind of women in the military novels, if you could put it that way, of the 19th century. Mrs. Eden Southworth's novel, Britomart the Man-Hater, which is all about the issue of women's ability to fight in the Civil War. And you have one woman character in there who cross-dresses and tries to enlist and is turned away and has a tantrum and said, why can men pay substitutes? Why can men fake ailments to get out of battle? And yet here I am, I'm patriotic, I want to fight, and they're not letting me.
In one of Alice Hoffman's recent books, it's a book of short stories that takes place in a particular house, over the years. One of the little stories in that is about a woman taking a man's place in battle because her situation is so dire. It's an escape for her, but also by taking his place, by adopting his identity, she allows him to stay home with his children.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And I think it's children. Maybe it's a child. But anyway, she, you know, it's, what do you think about that? Interesting. And that's, I think, how one of the ways I learned that actually you could pay someone to take your place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, as you're pointing out, I mean, that connection between serving in the military and being a citizen has never been quite as straightforward as people like to think.
Yeah.
But it's a convenient myth for us, I think.
Yeah. Did women, did they have to cross-dress, essentially, to fight in the Revolutionary War and in other conflicts of the 18th and 19th centuries?
They certainly did, and what many of them did, or at least several of them did, was cross-dress, fight, and then, after the war was over, write memoirs and go on theatrical tours and talk about their experiences because they were so provocative and unusual. So it's only been very recently that women have been able to enlist as women and fight as women. And I think especially in the Iraq War, what we're seeing now is people having to come to terms with the fact that women are in combat and that there are no such thing as front lines anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have this comforting fiction that women are just in support roles in the military, but the number of women soldiers who have been killed or wounded really speaks against that myth. It's interesting, I'm just starting off a new project, actually, which is an oral history and documentary about female soldiers who have come home wounded from the Iraq War. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see what they have to say about their experiences and to see how the American public reacts to them, because they're such a visible reminder of the contradictions in our policies and our ways of thinking about women in war.
Yeah. It's also interesting, it seems to me, that women enlist for so many different reasons, and likewise, the reasons women own guns are very varied as well.
Yes, and right now the gun industry is really pushing women to have guns as part of responsible motherhood and as a way of protecting themselves when the police can no longer do it for them. You know, it's funny, if you go back to the gun ads of 100 years ago, you see the gun industry marketing guns to women as part of essentially good citizenship. You know, if you want to be strong, if you want to help build a nation, let's get out there and hunt, or let's go out there and trap shoot because it's a great way to meet men. And now, if you look at the gun ads, they either portray single women alone in dark parking lots, or they portray suburban moms tucking their kids into bed at night. But the implication is usually that there's no man around and that the cops aren't necessarily going to be there to offer protection. You know, the woman's going to have to do it alone.
What does that say about our ideas at the moment about law and order?
I think it says that we see the state as more a hostile than a helpful force. You know, that we don't think that the state is going to be there to protect us. You know, we're all going to have to be vigilantes. I mean, that's part of the NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim campaign, I think. It's all about no one's going to be there for you. You don't need to be a victim. You can protect yourself.
So,
but the implication is really there that the cops aren't going to be there. And, in fact, in all the gun magazines, there are little anecdotes. you know, like the NRA's American Riflemen or Women and Guns magazine. They're anecdotes about people who were attacked and the cops weren't around and they defended themselves successfully using their guns.
Laura Browder is our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Her Best Shot, Women and Guns in America. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You know, it seems to me that long ago, the gun as a tool for protection and provision, to protect and provide, was something that was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But here again, at this point in our history, it seems what you're saying is again we're almost we're falling back on that kind of idea about where we are, where we live, a kind of new frontier.
Yeah, I think that's well put. I think if you do look around at gun ads, a lot of them have that frontier mentality. Gun ads for women, anyway.
Let's talk about a couple of figures,
mm-hmm.
women figures. Let's go way back to Molly Pitcher and then go to the Civil War and talk about Loretta Velasquez. Two very different figures, but they're very fascinating, and maybe you just give us a little bit of a thumbnail on each of these figures.
Well, the most important thing to say about Molly Pitcher is that she never really existed.
Right. She's a fictional
She's character. A fictional character. She's a composite. Historians have looked back and looked at the women whom she might have been based on, and to give you an idea of what they're like, one of them was known as Dirty Kate. And another one was, you know, famous for being syphilitic and drunken. These were tough women. They were not genteel women at all. When Molly Pitcher first emerged as a figure, a sort of quasi-historical figure, right before the Civil War, she was always portrayed as being a devoted wife. She was there to help her husband. You know, she was not a soldier in her own right at all. She was the perfect helpmate, perfect patriotic helpmate. And as the years went on, the myth grew stronger and stronger until, you know, generations of schoolgirls, school children were learning about this historical figure who never really happened. And I think she is a great illustration of, you know, that contradiction in the way we look at women with guns. You know, she was patriotic, and that was great, but she could never be portrayed as acting like a soldier, being rough like a soldier, or working on her own volition. She only got into battle after her husband fell. So fast forward from Molly Pitcher, this idealized, imaginary female soldier, to some of the women who fought in the Civil War. And you mentioned one of my favorites, Loretta Velasquez, who was a Confederate woman who wrote a very frank autobiography about her love of cross-dressing, her love of battle, the way she enjoyed violence, her competition with other soldiers in her unit, not only about who was the better fighter, but who could attract more women. You know, it was a very unusual autobiography, and it caused a lot of furor and then sank like a stone. You know, there were other women at that time who were publishing autobiographies about their work in battle, but they really soft-pedaled anything having to do with violence, and certainly never acknowledged any interest in cross-dressing for its own sake.
Yeah.
You know, one of them, Sarah Edmonds, had in fact been cross-dressing for years before she ever joined the Union Army. You know, that's what she did back at home on the farm. She dressed like a man. But if you read her autobiography, which was initially titled Unsexed, but whose title was changed to, you know, Memoirs of a Nurse and something else, you can't even tell when she's dressing as a woman and when she's dressing as a man, because the whole thing is so full of, you know, nice patriotic poems and reflections and musings that there's almost no violence in it.
Hmm. Let's talk with some listeners.
Yeah.
Our first listener calling in this afternoon is calling us from Chicago on line 4. Hi.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
I find this a very interesting topic because as an African-American, I think the role of women in the military especially and the role of African-Americans in some ways are very similar in the sense that at first there was a lot of resistance and then finally a grudging acceptance and then finally just acceptance altogether. Would you not agree with that? I think about the experience that Karen Hope Green had, for instance.
No, I think that's a great point, and I think there are many, many parallels. I think that the only big difference that we're going to see is that the role of being a soldier and dying in battle is something that people see as really interfering with motherhood. And I think that people are very uncomfortable with the idea of mothers leaving their children and maybe getting wounded or killed in battle.
Yeah, I noticed that during the second Gulf War, when they had Shoshana Johnson up and she looked terrified and people were saying, see, look at that, this poor woman, she's scared to death. That proves women shouldn't be in the lines. Well, everyone is frightened in the middle of war, if you have any sense.
That's right.
You know, it's, the guy who isn't or the woman who isn't, I think you better stay away from them if you want to survive.
That's right. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens as the war drags on and as we have more wars in which women take a more public combat role. You know, are we ever going to get over our feelings that women should be mothers first and soldiers second? I'm not sure. I think that African-American male soldiers didn't have that particular obstacle to get past in the public mind.
No, they didn't. I know in the first Gulf War, there was one colonel. I'm not going to mention his name, so you don't have to worry about cutting me off. I'm not going to say the guy's name. But he was on NBC as an advisor, and he was very bitter about women taking part in that war. He just didn't think it was necessary. He had fought in Vietnam, and I guess he had won quite a few medals. I think you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
A certain colonel, and he was very vehement. It reminded me, in a way, of the kind of opposition that African-Americans had in 48 when President Truman desegregated the military, and you had some commanders saying, look, as far as I'm concerned, nothing is going to change.
But, you know, on the other hand, look at the furor that was caused by Jim Webb's 1979 article, which George Allen's campaign unearthed here in Virginia during the Senate race here, where Jim Webb was saying, you know, women just want to be in the service so they can have more sex,
yes,
basically. And, you know, the naval dormitories are a horny woman's dream. Well, that caused a huge furor. So, on the one hand, yes. On the other hand, no. I mean, I think that even though we have so many stereotypes about female soldiers being oversexed, and there's a whole genre of softcore porn devoted to this subject, I think still when Jim Webb suggested this, when his old writings were unearthed, you know, people weren't comfortable with that at all.
That's right. And, you know, I was disappointed in a way when Karen Hope Green was killed on the in a plane crash on the Abraham Lincoln. Rule one, when a pilot goes down, the other pilots sort of rally around him and make sure that it isn't considered a pilot error.
Mm-hmm.
This didn't happen with her. I mean, it was just the opposite.
Interesting.
You had people saying, well, she shouldn't have been there in the first place, and yada, you know, things like that.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk with another listener, a listener in Charleston on line 1. Hi.
Yes, a couple of things. I wonder if your guest has Earl Browder in her family tree.
Yes, he's my grandfather, actually.
Oh, wonderful. Well, anyway, in Illinois here, I live in Charleston and commute back and forth to Champaign now and again in the southbound lane. of the state highway are these road signs.
Mm-hmm.
I can't give them justice, but the thrust of it is that a mother is home alone with her children, and the thief is breaking into the house, and she shoots him, and everyone is content again. I think it's just so bizarre. I just can't quote it properly, but nevertheless, the message is that women with guns and in domestic sorts of an environment and thievery, then is all that is solved by bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the NRA, but it's got a .com thing behind all, after, you know, it's like the old signs that
Burma Shave,
yes. Yeah.
Yes, and that's what it smacks off, but it's then related to gun violence. And the next thing would be, do you have knowledge of, I think that in World War II, Russian women fighter pilots were, there weren't many, but there was a unit of those women who fought valiantly in World War II. I don't know. I just have that knowledge tucked back in the corner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yes. Okay. Well, it women and war, you know, and war is reprehensible in any form, in my opinion, and that it doesn't solve anything. It just perpetuates itself, and it ends up being a social sort of phenomenon that we are yet to get past. But nevertheless, I enjoy the show, Celeste, and it's wonderful, and I'm glad that Mr. Browder is your grandfather. Kind of makes my day, because he was a great fellow in my book, you know, and he had lots of input there in the 20s and 30s, you know.
Well, it makes my day to hear you say that.
Yeah,
so.
Okay, and I think my father knew of him and attended. I'm originally from Terre Haute, Indiana, and Gene Debs and Earl Browder and those folk were around that area when my father was young. But nevertheless, you know, their work was not for nothing. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Laura Browder, author of her best shot, Women and Guns in America. We have about 6-7 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Do you see parallels in the debate over women in combat and the debate, which I suppose in some places might still be going on the civilian side, about women in the police force?
That's interesting. I haven't thought about that much, to tell the truth, because it wasn't something that came up much in my research. It wasn't something that people talked a lot about, but I certainly think the parallels are there. It's interesting, on the flip side of that, something that came up again and again and again throughout the 20th century is the public fear of the armed female criminal.
Yeah.
And the idea that if you gave a woman a gun, she would go hog wild and run around on a shooting spree or a stick-up spree or something of the sort, and the fear that this was related to feminism. It was an outgrowth of feminism. And you see this in all of the newspaper articles about the Brooklyn gun girls in the 1920s, who were, you know, there was an outbreak of armed robberies attributed to women. And there were lots of articles about these. J. Edgar Hoover in the 1930s wrote a book called Persons in Hiding about American crime, which he blamed on women not wanting to be good mothers and so raising criminal sons, or women wanting too much power and so becoming involved in crime themselves. Mm. And you see this in the 1960s and 70s when there were sociology textbooks published about how, you know, and popular books about how feminism was causing this crime wave. So even as we see a fear of women becoming soldiers or police, there's that opposite or parallel fear that women's strength or feminism will lead to female crime.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling with a footnote of sorts to the previous caller's comments.
Mm-hmm.
More specifically with three very short poems that appear on those, quote, Burma-style signs on the highway nearby. My quick survey, I see only three women showing up in these. One of them is Jane Sees Thug, Thug Sees Jane's Gun, Run, Thug, Run. There are two others that begin, my mom sleeps safe, she has no fear, and that's always because the gun is near, or
That's wild.
The thugs steer clear, or bang, they'll hear. So we have those all over. Usually there are four signs, maybe sometimes five, spaced out along the side of the interstate. You kind of get a line of the poem every couple of
seconds. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like that before, but it sounds very dramatic.
Yeah, it's all right. We see them all the time. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, for filling in the detail there. I've seen them too, but I wouldn't have been able to tell you what. I couldn't remember them, but they're interesting little pieces of rural Illinois. Before we wrap up, maybe you'd say a little something about, we can talk a little bit here about the bob-haired bandit who was found eventually. Her name was Celia Cooney.
Yes, and she, or her exploits, provoked a huge media frenzy in the middle of the 1920s. She was a stick-up woman, and the newspapers speculated that she was a flapper gone wild. One of my favorite headlines from that time says something like, is some strange breed of feminism causing this crime wave? And she was eventually found to be a woman with a very sad story, you know, someone who had been raised in foster care, who had been married, but who had had her baby die and had sort of turned to crime out of desperation. And at that point, newspaper columnists, including Walter Lippmann, wrote that rather than being a flapper, Celia Cooney was a great illustration of the need for better eugenics practices, that she shouldn't have been allowed to be born in the first place, because just look at what bad genes led her to.
Yeah.
So that gets us right back to one of the things we started talking about, the way that race and gun ownership have been tied up in our cultural conversations for a very, very long time.
Yeah. I don't know if you would agree. I'm trying to sort this out now as a way to sum up here, but this is so complex. You know, on the one hand, we have Molly Pitcher. We have Annie Oakley. Then we can think about the bob-haired bandit. We can think about, we can recall photos of Patty Hearst, gun in hand in a bank robbery. And something we haven't really talked about is guns used as a symbol of women's sexuality. We've kind of walked around that a little bit.
Well, we can end with the great image of G. Gordon Liddy's stacked and packed calendar. Which he publishes every year, and it's exactly what it sounds like. And one of my favorite images from that calendar, which I actually use in my book, is of a woman in a camo bikini with a grenade and a big crucifix dangling between her breasts and a giant like AK-47 or something like that.
With a blade on the end of it.
That's right.
and she's buff. And she's like in a camouflage bikini.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that, too, you know, I mean, there's an entire genre of softcore porn devoted to women with guns.
Yeah. Well, think of the Pulp Fiction that was popular in the 30s and 40s, and there's another example of that. So it looks like It looks like women and guns are going to continue to perplex us for a while.
Oh, I think for a very long time. I mean, I think, you know, especially in this country when we have such strong feelings about gun ownership and our national identity, I don't think the issue of women and guns is going to go away anytime soon.
There we'll leave it. Laura Browder, thank you very much for joining me this
thank
afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
And talking with our listeners this afternoon. Laura is the author of her best shot, Women and Guns in America. The book is published by the University of North Carolina Press.